Ethan Allen Institute presents Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre.
Our mission is to help people better understand the fundamentals of a free society: individual liberty, private property, and limited government.
Welcome, kindred spirits and listeners of all persuasions, to Common Sense Radio, brought to you by the Ethan Allen Institute, and today brought to you also by Champlain Valley Equipment, meeting all of your farm equipment needs throughout the state of Vermont, any size of farm, large or small. Also got a lot of equipment for homeowners, too. You want to check them out and see what they have to offer. I'd be very surprised if they don't have what you require. And so it is today, as it is every day, we visit with policy experts, business leaders, community leaders about important issues facing Vermont and her people. Today, we're going to learn more about Vermont agriculture. And in particular, we're going to take a look at the new water quality regulations and how they would affect our farmers, their ability to compete, to earn a living, indeed to sustain themselves and the environment they create for us all. And who better to help us do so than Bill Rao, farm leader and community leader from Franklin County. Bill, welcome to Common Sense Radio.
Yes, thank you. Good morning to you. Good morning, everyone.
We're glad to have you with us. Well, let's get started by you telling us about yourself. Tell us how you got started in agriculture and just how far you've come from the early days.
Well, I got started in agriculture by being raised on a dairy farm in the Northeast Kingdom in the town of Albany, back in the 50s and 60s. In the 50s, we milked about 40 cows, and in the 60s, we built a new barn and milked 60 cows.
Mm. Well, that's a one-third increase.
That was an increase. I tend to advocate on behalf of the farmer and agriculture. I think agriculture has a bright future. It's certainly of importance to us. If you sit down to the table and there isn't anything there,
we notice.
You'd point at the farmer.
We would, and yet we don't give the farmer, Bill, in my view, enough credit for creating the rural culture, the rural character, indeed many of the rural environmental benefits that which we all appreciate.
Well, the farmer works really quite diligently towards environmental success. Mm. They recognize the importance of their land, of their soils, of the nutrients on the farm, and the expense of the nutrients if they don't stay on the farm. And that's watched quite closely today by the regulators. Mm. And fair enough.
It is indeed. And that's going to be one of our themes today, Bill, because it's quite timely. You have water quality regulations that were legislation, I should say, that was passed under the name of Act 64. We're going to learn more about that. But then, as with every new law, it's implemented through regulation. And the regulations that will affect farmers are coming before the legislative committee that tests their legislative intent against the words in the regulation. You're going to help us understand that too. If you've got a question about agriculture, the new water quality regulations, or most any related topic, give us a call at 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. Bill will be happy to take a crack at your question. Bill, I know you've spent a lifetime preparing for this kind of challenge of new regulation, new laws. Tell us about some of the experiences you've had on other policy committees and other boards, maybe even a couple of the awards that you've won over the years.
Sure. Well, first of all, a person, once they engage the process, finds they end up sitting on too many boards.
It happens, doesn't it?
It's time consuming. But someone has to have some willingness to participate, to make things move, but also to improve things.
Hmm.
And I've tried to do my part. When when the farm bill was being developed, the last farm bill.
And that's the big one down in Washington.
In Washington. Mm-hmm. That was difficult. And dairy farmers weren't getting paid a fair dollar and aren't today. But we tried to improve national dairy policy. And we started as a small group here in Vermont to work to improve policy. And we have three federal delegates that we're good to work with, mm-hmm. excellent to work with. By the time we finished, we had a national coalition of farmers. It was called the Greater Coalition. And that included people from as far away as California. We worked to get a bill in the House and a bill in the Senate. We ended up with a bill in both the House and the Senate. We tried to implement a management tool to help balance the supply of milk with the demand. And we had 66 votes in the Senate. We had the votes in the House, but the Speaker of the House wouldn't schedule the bill for a vote because he feared that we would end up getting our management tool. Hmm. And why was that a problem? One of the problems we have in government today is PAC money. Hmm. He'd apparently had too much PAC money, so he wouldn't schedule a bill for a vote. So we didn't get our management tool, which we really needed in a situation like today.
What was the particular issue bill to which he objected?
He said it was a socialist style. He said it's a Soviet style of regulation.
Well, those would be fighting words, wouldn't they?
Well, they were.
Okay, we've got Bill Rowell with us today. We're going to learn more about agriculture. We're going to learn more about the dairy industry in particular, and also about the upcoming changes in water quality regulation as it affects our dairy farms, and it affects all of our farms, and as we've discussed before on this show, our woodlands too, and our municipalities. We discussed with the Chamber of Commerce last week, and of course our commercial businesses. We all, Bill, want clean water. Nobody wants it more than the farmers of our state. The question is, how can we work towards that goal in a way that minimizes the cost to the people who have to comply with the rule and enforce the rule and monitor it, and also the cumbersomeness and the time it takes to comply? We all care about the environment, don't we?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Indeed we do. And you have worked over the years, we can now start to say, Bill, over the decades, in various groups to improve water quality. Tell us about one of them.
Well, in 2005, some people came to the farm and they were talking about digesters. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what a digester was. And they said, well, it's the new way of handling a large waste stream. So I ended up going to Austria and Germany with a small group of farmers to look at digesters. Mm-hmm. And by 2006, we were in the construction process to put a digester on our farm. That was commissioned early in 2007. And since that time, it produces about 2 million kilowatt hours of electricity to the grid mm-hmm. each year.
That's a lot of electricity.
It is. And fairly consistent. It's part of the base load. It has some air quality and water quality attributes. And in conjunction with the digester, if you look at the digester as a tool, there are some other things that are now coming to the forefront that have just recently been developed. One is a means of sequestering the phosphorus from the waste stream to partition it. So you can take from 65 up to 95% of the phosphorus out of the manure waste stream and put it in a sludge that is both storable and stackable, which means you can move it to another region. You can move it to the farther fields. You can sell it to someone if you don't need it. It gives you a better use of the phosphorus that we have available to us and without overloading the soils.
Mm-hmm. So this is a way of taking the manure that's produced by the cows and on the farm, making energy from it, which is a good accomplishment right in itself. Electricity, we all require that. But at the same time, improving the water quality situation by removing phosphorus from the cycle where it gets put back on the soil and goes into the streams. You've sequestered it just the same as we talk about sequestering carbon dioxide. Sometimes you've sequestered the phosphorus and you can ship it to some place where it's needed and it won't cause water quality problems. Is that the way it works?
That's the way it works, and it also saves the farmer money, or it may even in some cases make the farmer money.
Those are the kind of solutions we like to find here in Vermont, and Bill Rowell's helping accomplish them. Artie Levine, let's swing over to Barry and ask George to join our conversation. George, what say you?
Well, Bill, I have to say I'm somewhat surprised by the appearance on a libertarian show of a guest who supports basically a price cartel.
Okay, George.
My grandparents had a farm in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Farming is a tough life. I'm sympathetic with farmers, but farmers do not occupy some high moral ground. And a cow is not a sacred animal. There are too many cows. There's too much milk, and the price that we pay for price supports for farmers of any kind is a regressive tax on the people who are least able to pay for it. And it's pork barrel. And if it was Speaker Boehner who didn't bring that bill to a vote, God bless him, because he has my support. Well, and that's all. I'll wait for Bill Rao to refute what I have to say.
Well, I think you're right. God bless him is correct, because you notice that he left Congress after the Pope visited, so something wasn't right there in the first place.
Well, George, we love you, and we have the highest respect for you. And you know, I have strong libertarian beliefs, too. And we also believe, though, in having a good discussion with a wide range of points of view, and so we're glad that you called today to give the libertarian point of view on this particular question. I would add that agriculture has indeed struggled to find the right balance of free markets and planning for many, many decades, going back into at least to the 1920s. And has never fully resolved that natural tension that is underway. And what we're striving to find here in Vermont is a way that we can sustain our farms, our agriculture, in a way that minimizes the environmental impact, and matter of fact, improves it, recognizing that not only are they an important part of our economy, but also absolutely essential to creating the backdrop, the scenic views that people are coming to from all over the world to see today and in October, and the recreation opportunity and other environmental benefits that all of us enjoy throughout the year. So I know where you're coming from, George, and I know it's heartfelt, and you know that I agree with you in many, many ways. We're trying to find the right balance, and Bill is helping us do so today. And on this last point you just made, Bill, it seems to me that the digester that takes the manure, produces electricity, improves air quality, and removes phosphorus from the cycle is just the kind of solution we're trying to find that protects both the economy and the environment. Give us your further thoughts.
Well, the digester on our farm was a $2.75 million project. in conjunction with a digester, these new tools that are being developed that are just now coming to the forefront and are actually working on some farms as prototypes will be something that we hope to see a wave of in the future, so that we'll see more farms with these capabilities. Another thing that works with a digester is the drag line operation, where you can pump manure from your manure lagoon out to the fields as far as 2 miles away through pipes or hoses to a tractor with a toolbar, which injects the manure.
Directly into the soil,
so there isn't any odor associated with it because it's covered up immediately. And, you know, it's gotten to the point where neighbors are waving with all five fingers.
Well, that's a lot better than the alternative. And I might add also another way that helps the environment is that it avoids the, or minimizes the risk of runoff from when you apply the, as compared with when you apply the manure on the surface.
It reduces the potential for runoff. It reduces the amount of loss of nitrogen into the atmosphere. And the digester also uses the methane. Rather than it being released into the atmosphere, the methane is used to turn the engine to produce the electricity in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Now, another issue that comes up is sedimentation in the streams, and often that's a proxy for phosphorus, because the soil will have phosphorus locked inside of it. But there's something called cover cropping that more and more farmers are using these days. Tell us about what you do.
Well, we cover crop fairly extensively each year when we remove our corn. We've just completed a few hundred acres of cover cropping here a couple of weeks ago.
And tell us what that means. You harvest the corn, and then what?
And then we plant winter rye, mm-hmm. so that it holds the soil in place in the fall. And then again in the spring. It also works in the soil so that the soil remains productive. It's just a more productive way of working the soil.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've got these new regulations coming along, and as George points out, many, many of our listeners feel quite strongly about the importance of improving water quality. We all want Lake Champlain improved, and that means improving all the tributaries, the streams, the rivers, and even the brooks that flow into Lake Champlain, directly or indirectly. And to that end, the legislature passed a law here year before last, Act 64, I think it was called.
Correct.
Tell us more about Act 64, and in particular what it means to farming.
Well, Act 64 originally was intended to bring the small farms into compliance. The large farms and the medium farms operate under permit, mm-hmm. Granted by the state. They're reviewed each year, and those farms operate under a nutrient management plan, which says that each of your fields have to be soil tested, and the nutrients have to be determined for what application that field can take for additional manure. In other words, manure for the upcoming year. And the idea is not to nutrient load the soil to the point where that it runs into the tiles or ditches or down to the streams and to the lake.
Mm-hmm.
So Act 64 said, okay, we're going to bring the small farms into compliance, and now as we see it, some of those farms, some of the smaller operations are exempt. I thought really it was an all-in approach, but there are some that are exempt, and the small farms, this was supposed to be the tool to bring them into compliance.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like it may exceed its authority to some extent, because There's new language for the large farms and the medium farms as well. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a loose definition of terms, so that if you and I look at a ditch and we agree that's a ditch, someone else may come along and define a ditch differently. So there are a few things that we need to work on to tighten up the rule. In other words, we formed a Vermont Dairy Producer Alliance to speak for the farmer. We went to the state of Wisconsin, where they've seen this sort of action before in 7 or 8 different states in the Great Lakes region, where they had water quality issues. And rather than reinvent the wheel, we hired them along with a corporation, a science-based corporation, recognized worldwide for their efforts. And the idea was, how do we make this the best? How do we get the best out of it for our buck? Mm-hmm. This is going to cost us about $100,000 as farmers this year to hire these people and move this effort forward.
That's the alliance hiring an advisor will cost you that.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. We also hired some folks to work for us in Montpelier, Shoal Dice Associates, to represent us. It's gotten to where that it's too difficult for the farmers to run to Montpelier every time there's an issue. We need some boots on the ground in Montpelier. And they're going to work on our behalf. But the idea is this. If you really want water quality improvement, then you should work with us, because we want water quality improvement also. Mm-hmm. We're going to be held accountable for it. It's not just the farmers that have the problem with water quality. It's all of us. Mm-hmm. But others seem to feel that it indemnifies them by pointing a finger at the farmer. That doesn't solve the water quality issue. If we tighten up the rules and the definitions and get rid of some of the ambiguous language, we probably stand a good chance of doing something. I don't want to spend thousands of dollars and years down the road find out that we didn't make any gain, or we actually went backwards in the state of Vermont.
And that's a risk when you, whenever the executive branch is writing rules to implement legislation, or even the legislation itself, when there's a term that's ambiguous or hard to interpret, it creates uncertainty for the industry, whatever it may be, manufacturing, retail, or agriculture. And when there's uncertainty, you're less inclined to invest, you're less inclined to grow, you're less inclined to hire people. So you want to have words in regulations and law that everybody agrees on what they mean, so that you can comply.
Correct. Mm-hmm. If I want clean water and you want clean water, and you give me a recipe, give me one for success. Don't give me one to experiment and then fail and then point a finger at me and say, you didn't do it right.
Mm-hmm. We've heard, Bill, as I listen to you, very similar concerns expressed by every sector of the economy, that that these new rules, despite their lofty goals, may not have the effect of improving water quality, but will have the effect of raising the cost of doing business. That's not a good policy for anybody.
Well, the environmental attorneys are able to compare the regulations in other states.
We'll pick that up after we take a break for important messages and news headlines. We'll be back with Bill Rao to learn more about agriculture, more about the dairy industry, and more about the new regulations that affect our farmers' ability to earn a living. Stay tuned.
$10,000 off a 2016 GMC Yukon or $10,000 off a 2016 GMC Sierra HD pickup truck and select model bonus cash on some of our hardest to find pickup trucks. October is Truck Month and the Auto Saver Group's Capital City Buick GMC location in Montpelier is making deals. Capital City knows price means nothing without selection, so we have you covered there as well. With over 500 new Buicks and GMC trucks available, we are bound to have the exact truck for you. So turn that truck around now and head to Capital City Buick GMC in Montpelier, where the Select Model Bonus Cash Program will save you over $10,000. Capital City Buick GMC and GMC Trucks, we are professional grade. So if your truck already has a Capital City sticker on the back of it, everyone here would like to say thank you. If not, visit us online at CapitalCityAuto.com, or we are located just 1 mile from the roundabout in Montpelier.
AP Update, I'm Rita Foley. Those on Social Security will get a little bit of a raise in their benefits beginning next year, but it's not going to be much. AP correspondent Diane Kepley reports from Washington that the federal government announced this morning how much it's going to be and why it's so little.
The amount of the cost of living adjustment for next year is just 0.3%. People getting federal retirement benefits can blame low inflation rates. The average monthly Social Security payment is $1,238, which means, on average, recipients can expect less than $4 a month more in benefits. This is the fifth consecutive year that benefits have shown little or no increase. More than 70 million people receive Social Security payments. Diane Kepley, Washington.
Senator Bernie Sanders, until recently a presidential candidate, is pushing to expand Social Security. He says those who are on it are our parents and our grandparents, the people, he says, who built this country. AP Update, I'm Rita Foley.
How does an online retailer have a warehouse sale? Well, at HouseNeeds.com, they do it the old-fashioned way. In their warehouse, the Green Warehouse next to Shaw's on Mad River Canoe Road in Waitsfield. And for one day only, Saturday, October 29th from 9 till 3. Everything is on sale. Wood stoves, tankless water heaters, gas and oil burners, solar hot water, solar fans, radiant heating and plumbing supplies, Honeywell thermostats, smoke alarms, ventilators, hearth accessories, and a whole bunch more. You'll find deep, deep discounts on discontinued products, scratch and dent products, display model wood stoves, special order cancellations and overstocks. For more information, call 802-583-5500. And you'll get a free HouseNeeds.com mug with every purchase. When you have your morning coffee, you'll remember what a great decision it was to come to the HouseNeeds.com warehouse sale at their Green Warehouse next to Shaw's on Ned River Canoe Road in Waitsfield. One big sale, one day only. Saturday, October 29th from 9 till 3.
Chevy Truck Month is going on now at Cody Chevrolet Cadillac. Now through October 31st, find your tag on a new 2016 Chevy Silverado LT Double Cab All-Star Edition and get up to $10,500 off in total value savings. Or lease for just $279 per month for 36 months with $3,200 due at signing. See us for details. Hurry in today during Chevy Truck Month at Cody Chevrolet Cadillac, Central Vermont's number one Chevy dealer. Another reason, Cody is why, Chevy's the buy. Chevrolet, find new roads.
Mayhem is everywhere.
I'm a gravel truck. I'm busy laying the foundation for your city's newest suburb.
You're stuck behind me, and I'm about to make it rain. Rocks. Now you're swerving, but there's no avoiding this downpour.
Better watch out for that guardrail.
So get Allstate, where agents help protect you from mayhem, like me.
Call Waterbury Allstate Agent Marine Insurance today, 244-5634, subject to terms, conditions, and availability.
The election of November 8th presents two choices, progressivism or constitutionalism. Established in natural law, constitutionalism believes you possess creator-endowed rights to your life, liberty, and property which government is instituted to secure. Progressivism rejects this for history's evolution in the planned society. The individual replaced by the common good. The laws of nature and nature's God erased for the common good. Everything in the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state defines totalitarian society. And this reveals the ends of progressivism's deceptive gradualism. At Gettysburg, Lincoln called for a constitutional rebirth, as we should now, when he said that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. This freedom's at risk, as progressivism and constitutionalism are irreconcilable. And herein lies our house divided and your existential choice. paid for by Tom Licata for State Senate.
We have so many amazing things to be proud of here in Vermont, and technology is one of them. Champlain College is known for its innovative programs, and we're working on some very cool projects. We'll be at Tech Jam to share and inspire Vermonters.
The 2016 Vermont Tech Jam, presented by North Country, your community credit union, is coming to the Champlain Valley Expo on Friday and Saturday, October 21st and 22nd. Admission is free. Recruiters from Vermont's fastest growing and most innovative companies will be there looking for new employees and demonstrating their products.
I encourage all students and job seekers to attend Tech Jam because it's the single best opportunity to see how Vermont is using technology. Some of the top Vermont-based companies are represented, and this year is your chance to network with some of the experts that helped create our tech community. I'm Jonathan Rajewski, the director of the Senator Patrick Leahy Center for Digital Investigation at Champlain College, and I look forward to seeing you there.
For more information on the Vermont Tech Jam, powered by 7 Days, visit techjamvt.com. That's techjamvt.com.
This is my right, a right given by God, to live a free life, to live in freedom, talking about
Welcome back to Common Sense Radio. Today, brought to you by Champlain Valley Equipment, growing to meet all your needs on the farm or off the farm. They serve almost the whole state of Vermont. They got stores and offices and show places in Berlin, Derby, East Randolph, Middlebury, and St. Albans throughout our listening area. And if you require some new equipment, want to know about the latest technology and the latest ideas to be a more successful and more productive farmer, you should visit Champlain Valley Equipment and see how they can help you as they grow to meet your needs. Today we're visiting with Bill Rao, who's a farm leader from Franklin County and deeply involved in policy on milk and on regulation. Right now, today, we're talking about the new water quality regulations and how they affect our farmers and therefore affect us all. If you want to learn more about the Ethan Allen Institute or about Champlain Valley Equipment, go to either of their websites, read the commentaries there, get the information about Champlain Valley Equipment. And if you see fit for Ethan Allen, make a contribution and help keep us going. As we get ready to return to Bill in our discussion of Vermont agriculture, it also gives me a chance to remind you to listen to Mike Smith before our show goes on the air today. Governor Jim Douglas substituting for Mike and doing a great job, as he always does. After, we've got the Midday News Service. And then at 1 o'clock today, Travin will be with us. A little different point of view. George, you might want to give Travin a call, too, because you might find similar opportunities to comment as you did earlier today. George, you know we love you, and I'm just pulling your leg now. And then after Travin, you get the getaway with Artie Levine. Always great interviews and great music. And at 4 o'clock, Lee comes back with, Lee Cattell comes back with the 4 o'clock news. Bill Rao, as we return to agriculture, I want to pay respect to the criticism we got earlier about the proper role. Let's put it this way: a question about the proper role for government in setting milk prices. And I want to come back to the point that this has been a battle where the industry and the markets and the government and all those who care about public policy have gone back and forth many times. We know the libertarian argument: let the market decide price, supply, and demand, and let the people decide through the demands that they express and what they're willing to buy and willing to pay, and producers in their cost of production, and where the two intersect, supply and demand will set the price and set the volume. That's generally the way we approach most markets in America. But we want to hear your side of the story about why agriculture, particularly milk production, is different.
Well, I don't disagree with that approach to the marketplace. I think that's a good approach. But milk production is a perishable product. It doesn't have a very long shelf life. And we have, as farmers, we have no real tool to control production once the market is, if the market is saturated and can't absorb another drop of milk. And especially now that we seem to be participating in a global economy.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget, last year, the European Union, they produced 360 billion pounds of milk a year. The U.S. produces about 215 billion pounds of milk a year. So they're much bigger than we are. But the EU 32, that's 32 member countries, some from Eastern Europe. And when the EU did away with their management tool that had been in place since 1982, the increased amount of milk on the market began to flood the market. But that wasn't the real case. You talk about the role of government in milk production. The trouble that the West had with Russia for their aggression towards some of their states caused Russia to close its door to the West.
Hmm.
Russia is the European Union's largest export partner. And with that door closed, where does all that increased supply of milk go? Some of it's coming here. It's flooded the world market.
Mm-hmm. So it's all mixed up in foreign policy, foreign politics, and we might add the emerging markets in India and China are very important, and we want them to prosper. We want, through free trade, for their incomes to grow, because when they have more income, they'll buy more dairy products, will they not?
That's correct. They will.
So our ultimate goal is the same, regardless of where we come down on the way to achieve this goal. We want more demand for the product of our working farms, and we just have a little different idea about how to accomplish an income for our farms that allows them to sustain themselves. And here's where it gets very complicated, because if our farmers cannot sustain themselves, they have no choice but to go out of business. The land use will change in ways that will be worse for the environment, not better. And plus, we will lose the general character and culture that most all of us who live in Vermont value and treasure so much. So we have to navigate through these competing goals to try and find a policy that can transition us to a point where incomes are sustainable, water quality improves, and we protect all the other environmental benefits too. That's what we're trying to accomplish.
Well, probably it was 40 years ago, there were 10,000 farms in Vermont,
mm-hmm.
small farms. Today, there are 868 farms left in Vermont, dairy farms I'm talking, and 749 of those are small farms. 130 are medium-sized farms. A small farm is 200 cows or less. A medium farm is 200 to 699 cows. And a large farm is 700 cows or more. There are 25 large farms in the state of Vermont.
And the large farms, if I was listening carefully earlier, Bill, all are in compliance with and regulated through what's called a large farm operator permit.
That's correct.
And so for some time now,
yes.
They've been subject to a fairly strict regulation. It's been the smaller farms that have come along later, and that's where much of the controversy now has emerged, because there's so many of them. scattered throughout the state of Vermont, and they all have a representative in Montpelier, and they're letting him or her know how they feel.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult time when you challenge the rule. It's a difficult time when you recognize you have a problem and you don't have an all-in approach. It's a difficult time when you recognize that the rules to move forward with need to be tightened up if you want to be successful.
Mm-hmm. And part of being successful is just helping people understand better the challenges and the opportunities that Vermont agriculture faces. When a farmer is a distant person, not a neighbor, just someone that you read about in the newspaper or in some magazine, it's much easier to say, well, he may be ill-intended. He may not care about the environment. So part of the progress we need to make is to improve awareness and understanding that nobody cares about the environment more than our farmers, because if you lose your environment, you lose your natural resource base. Your thoughts?
That's correct. Well, I'd remind everybody that farmers represent the boots on the ground. If we're going to accomplish these projects, we're going to do it to a large extent with the farmers' money, also with cost sharing, but it's going to be the farmers' effort, and the farmer is going to be held accountable. Agriculture and forestry account for better than 80% of Vermont's land base.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think you're going to do that by yourself without the farmers, you're kidding yourself.
We want all of us working together. Artie Levine, let's turn to Sheldon and ask Ruth to join our conversation. Ruth.
Yes, good morning, Bill and Bill.
Morning.
Good morning.
I don't know Bill Rao, but I did go to his open house this fall or summer, and I was very impressed with his farm. Very impressed.
Did you get your plate of pancakes?
Yes, we did. We were very hungry. It must have been all that fresh air. Yeah, we really enjoyed it. It was very impressive how clean your barns are and how happy your staff is and how many other farmers were helping you on that day, being volunteers and stuff. It was all a very, very positive thing.
We hosted that event, Vermont Breakfast on the Farm, Ruth. We hosted that for the Vermont Agency of Agriculture and University Extension Service, and we had about 100 volunteers.
Right.
Helping us, and we had a nice day, and we fed 1,100 people pancakes and sausage with Vermont maple syrup in about less than 5 hours.
Can't beat that. That was quite a day, wasn't it, Ruth? Well, Ruth, tell us at your table with your friends and neighbors who were sitting with you and getting the tour of the barns and the farm with you. Tell us how they were reacting and what do you think they may have learned?
Well, we were all impressed. We were all happy. We were amazed at how clean the barns were. And I asked, are they always that clean? Of course, it was an open house, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yes, absolutely, always that clean. And I wanted to talk about how we're being regulated to death. And I have a piece of land, and we have to abide by the Shoreland Protection Act. We have to abide by the best agricultural practice law. We went to an educational thing at the museum in St. Albans, the historical museum, where Chuck Ross was there, and they were talking about the required agricultural practices. And somebody asked, how are you going to regulate all these laws? And Chuck Ross was sitting right there, and he said, don't worry, your neighbors will report you. And I thought that was horrible, and I wished I would have jumped up and said something right at that point, but I was just speechless.
Well, you're saying something today, Ruth, and Chuck's a pretty good guy. I know we sometimes disagree with him, but I know his heart's in the right place, and he didn't mean it necessarily way.
I'm not criticizing anything he said.
Okay.
No, I'm just telling you what Chuck Ross said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's awful.
Well,
I want to bring up another issue in Franklin County, which is, and I'm sure Bill is very aware of this, is the wind tower thing on Swanton Ridge. They don't have to abide by any of the rules and regulations that the farmers and the shoreline owners have to abide by. And I don't think that's right, because they're going to cause a lot of pollution and a lot of damage to the water quality.
Well,
they say there's no scientific studies to prove that this is going to happen. But is there any scientific studies to prove that all of this stuff that the farmers are being required to do is really going to work? That would be my question. And thank you.
Well, thank you, Ruth. Bill, you want to take a crack at this wind turbine controversy?
I do. You know, as an industry, I think the farmers are committed to supporting new regulations that are crafted in a way that is measurable, affordable, and reasonably feasible to achieve. If you look at the TMDL, the load of nutrients coming down the streams, that can be measured. And where does it come from? It comes from forestry and agriculture and municipalities and whoever else is in that watershed.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we determine who's responsible for what part? Well, it's believed that farmers are responsible for 40% of the problem. Okay? And that's on 80% of the land base or more. What about the other 60% of the land, 60% of the problem on the remaining less than 20% of the land base? And the thing that's kind of gotten under my skin a bit is pointing the finger at the farmer as being the problem. It doesn't solve the problem, and it doesn't indemnify anyone by doing it.
Mm-hmm. I might modify your estimates just a little. Forestry and agriculture, I think, are together pushing 90% of the land base. And the gurus have assigned 16% to forestry, and the forestry people take exception to that because a lot of it is background flow that would occur whether a single tree was cut or not. So there's lots to be learned, I think, is what it tells me, Bill, and we better be focusing on the goal and not, as you say, just trying to assign the blame to farmers and foresters. We've all got our part to do. And if we devise strategies that will minimize the burden for accomplishing the goal, then we'll get there. If we try to overburden one sector or another, or we try to increase taxes and spend the money in ways that don't do much good, then we won't ever get to the goal we want to achieve.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. You know, Bill, one item we were discussing before the show was the continuing education that goes on at the University of Vermont. Well, the education in college too, and the university has a dairy farm. And that's probably one of the many advisory boards you're on, Bill, is to how to get the most for our education dollars. And with modern dairy going so much larger, the question arose, do we just keep making the dairy farm there at UVM bigger and bigger, or can we figure out a way to partner with our private farms so that we can use them as a workshop, as a demonstration to educate our students about modern agriculture? Your thoughts?
Well, if you look at the university and where it's positioned in, I guess you'd call it an urban area, you're certainly going to have some objections to odor and traffic, I suppose. today on farms, animals are grouped according to their stage of maturity, their stage of pregnancy, or their stage of lactation. And they're fed a diet specific to each group. And on our farm, I think we have 16 different diets specific to that group, each of those groups. The university needs to work with animals in groups of similarity. And they're looking for numbers within the groups. And to try to do that in a tie stall barn in a small facility is difficult for them. I don't know that it's even possible in some cases. It depends what the study is. So rather than to try to do that, what do you need at the university? Well, they need a small dairy facility, a modern dairy facility. The one they had was 40-something years old, where animals can be worked through a clinic. And I can understand that, but what are you going to do to solve the issue of attracting students, attracting professors, and gaining the grant funding to accomplish this if you don't have the groups of animals for your College of Agriculture, your animal science programs, and life sciences? So the suggestion was this. If you're going to look outside for a farm, look at maybe a conserved farm in the area. You could probably buy it for less money. If you don't want to do that or can't do that, then look at partnering with some existing farms in the area. So we ended up being one of their partnering farms for experiments. There are several farms that participate with the university so that we don't lose our College of Agriculture in the state of Vermont.
Well, that's a mighty worthy goal, because we love our College of Agriculture and all those who are part of it. Bill Rao, farm leader, community leader, public policy expert, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your experiences and your insight on these important agriculture issues.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening and helping us work through these very complicated regulatory issues for Vermont agriculture. And thanks to all of you who call with a different point of view, because we really appreciate it. That's how we learn, by listening to each other and each of us doing our best to find common ground and a way to keep our farms successful here in Vermont, providing rural character, and at the same time, allowed to earn a living. Keep listening to WDEV. Tomorrow, another great show. Until then, keep thinking, keep learning, and most of all, keep the faith.